Got it. Instructions of Rabbinic literature, we always ask to consider the question, does this conclusion really seem to be drawn from the Torah, or are the rabbis using the verses they choose to justify their own position? And they're projecting it back to ancient history, projecting the Pesach back to ancient history. This is great. I don't actually know if the Mishnah is projecting it back to ancient history. And if they are, it's not clear to me that it isn't in fact the way the Pesach was prepared and brought in temple times in the Second Temple period. Certainly this is not the reality at all of the First Temple period, but I don't think that they ever claim that that is the case. I think they're just saying, like, they seem to be claiming this is the reality in the Second Temple period, and it's not obvious that it isn't the reality in the Second Temple period. I'll give you my favorite example of when the Mishnah is sometimes bizarrely accurate, when they have no right to. So it's, you know, over 200 years since the, nearly 200 years since the destruction of the temple. The Mishnah, when describing the temple, talks about a gate, which is called the Gate of Nicanor, which there was no historical corroboration of whatsoever in any document other than the Mishnah itself. Josephus describes the whole temple. He never mentions the gate. You know, loads of other historians who describe the temple never mention this Gate of Nicanor. The early 20th century, they found a grave in Eretz Israel with an inscription that said, here lies Nicanor, who donated the gates. So it's just a bizarre example of, like, sometimes the Mishnah has has knowledge that no one else has, and actually accurate knowledge of Second Temple times of the first century that no one else bothered to remember, even other people who were alive during the time, like Josephus. So so basically what I'm saying is, yes, it's definitely possible that are retrojecting history. They do that. But it's not obvious to me that Pesach is actually the example of it. It seems to me that Pesach is fairly faithful to the Second Temple period, but it's hard to know because there's not enough information. In terms of conclusions which don't seem logical from the sources, the way it's been expressed to me most interestingly, I think, is, like, you know, we're trained to sort of prize pshat, the simple reading of the text, like how little context you need in order to understand what the simple words are saying, that they're saying. And it just depends on how you understand what pshat means. Like, pshat might mean, let me remove any other context and only deal with the text itself and forget about everything else I know. That might get you a close shot. That's like sort of the academic approach. For example, you know, like biblical criticism tries to do this. Basically, like, let's peel away everything I think I know about the Torah and try to work on it from first principles and try to work out what are the constituent parts. And then you'll find that the original pshat of those constituent parts was nothing like necessarily the pshat that we would understand from later time. But that's not the only understanding of what pshat might mean. Pshat just means sort of contextual understanding, and it's not necessarily obvious that the only relevant context is the text itself. The relevant context might be the world that you live in as well. So when you're talking about what pshat means, what they thought of when they were interpreting the Torah, they might be interpreting it in light of their surroundings, which might be a real understanding of what pshat means. Like, in some ways it doesn't make any sense to interpret a divine document without reference to your surroundings. Actually, that's kind of nonsensical. It's a divine document, it's talking to us right now. It can't be that it's only lost in the past. It must be referring to current circumstances. I think a really interesting way of seeing this is, like, the difference practice in scribal Jewish scribes in Sfarad and Ashkenaz. This is obviously very generalized. But in general, Sephardi scribes thought, in order to be show fidelity and reverence to the text that they're copying, they have to copy it exactly as it is, without changing anything. Even if it doesn't make any sense, that's what the text says, they have to copy it exactly in that way. Ashkenazi scribes had a different approach, which is that in order to show their reverence to the text that they copied, they would correct anything they thought didn't make any sense. Because their reverence was, well, it can't be that this text doesn't make sense. It must be that this text has deep meaning. So therefore, I'm just going to correct what it says in order to make sure that that's true. The fidelity of the text in a different way. So I think that also plays out some of these things. Yes, I'm not saying it isn't worthwhile to find out, to think about what these things meant in the original context. But what I'm saying is that's not the only way to do it. And that's like a very modern way of doing it today, which is pretty foreign to ancient readers. They were much more likely to think about the pshat of the world as well as the pshat of the text. And those two things go hand in hand. And Andrew, I agree with you. Certainly the Mishnah does retrospect. I'm not saying it doesn't retrospect. And yes, this may not be the best example of it. Great. But I guess the other point is the Mishnah doesn't really care about historical accuracy. That's not a thing that they prize. And when you're talking about unnecessary details, I'll tell you the best thing I learned about this, which is that the Torah spends a long time talking about the laws of when an ox gores people. You know, an ox gores someone else or a slave or other animals or whatever. Spends a long time on this. It turns out that actually there are many ancient Near Eastern law codes deal with the law of the goring ox. So it sounds like the law of the goring ox is a very common occurrence, right? It seems like oxes were out goring people all the time. So therefore all the lawyers had to work out what to do in such scenarios. But the kicker is that archaeologists have also found vast materials of actual court documents from the ancient Near East and have never found a single actual live case of a goring ox. As far as we can tell, it's never happened. In which case, what's the point of the law? Right? Why did you go into so much detail about this? And I think that reveals something about what they thought about law, which is not necessarily about the specific details. They think that law, the details of the law elucidate principles, which can be applied elsewhere. It's sort of like training. It's like the way to sort of train yourself into the how to think correctly, how to approach new scenarios. The way you do that is by learning the cases of old scenarios. It's very case focused. So they don't give, the Mishnah and the Torah both operate in this way. They don't give you sort of broad principles about how to do a thing. They give you a specific case law because you're supposed to take the specific cases, the very specific scenarios, and generalize principles from them and like learn how to apply those in new situations that the previous text never talked about. So that's ideally what the Mishnah can do. Anyway, thanks for the opportunity for that aside. Happy to continue that conversation anyway. But I think we can finish Pesachim today. So let's kick it off. What I have as well is I made a diagram, which I'll try to manipulate on the screen, and we'll see if it's helpful. I don't know. You'll let me know if this is a helpful learning tool or irrelevant. Okay, so we sort of started this mission before. We are going to continue. We started yesterday, so we're going to continue in with it. So this is the diagram I made very quickly just now. So these represent people, the faces. You can see the diagram. You can see my cursor. Yeah, and the clouds represent sheep. I couldn't find an easy sheep to make, so I just found. But there was an easy cloud, so I figured it was close enough. Link for the Mishnah is in the chat. So basically what happened, these people were all one group. They all decided to be part of one group. They were all registered for this sheep. This sheep vanished. It went away. Let's see what I can do about that. Yeah, there you go. It's gone. So what are they going to do? What they do is these four tell this one person, hey, go and find us a new sheep. So he goes off on his own and he finds a new sheep and slaughters it. But in the meantime, the original group found the original sheep and slaughtered that one as well. And now what happens is it depends on the order in which this happened. So if the order was this, such that the agent slaughtered his sheep before the rest of the group slaughtered theirs, then this person is an agent. This person is acting on behalf of the whole group. When he slaughtered his lamb, he did it on behalf of everyone. Everyone eats this lamb. Okay, clear? Okay, now what happens if they slaughtered their animal first, before the agent did? In that scenario, they both eat their own lambs. They become essentially two groups. He went and did it by himself. They went and did it by themselves. They have two different sheep. That's fine. The problem comes when we don't know which order they came in. No, not that one. I want this one. You don't know which order they were slaughtered in. In that scenario, I don't know where this group is connected to. Sorry, let me make that the correct size. I don't know which Pesach this group is connected to. They could be connected to this one, like maybe this guy was their agent, or maybe this guy was too late and they'd already done it themselves. So I don't know which Pesach they're attached to. And therefore, they can actually eat no Pesachs whatsoever. They did get neither of these Pesachs. Both of them have to be burnt. By the way, in this scenario as well, when they both eat the new one, the old one also has to be burnt. It's an invalid Pesach. But the Mishnah doesn't say so explicitly. That seems to be the case. But this person, I know for sure which Pesach is his because he slaughtered one. And he was not involved in the slaughtering of this one. So in this scenario, this one gets to eat this lamb, and these get to eat no lambs because we don't know which one is theirs. Okay? Was that a helpful diagram? Okay. Great. Okay, so now let's read that in the text of the Mishnah, and then we'll see the other twists on this circumstance. So Chavurah she'avad pischa, a group which lost its Pesach, v'amra le'echad, and they said the group said to one person, "Say uvikesh u'shchot aleinu, go and seek and slaughter for us a lamb." V'halach u'matzav v'shachat, he went and found and slaughtered. V'hein b'achu v'shachatu, and they also did that. Im shalom nishchat rishon hu achel mishalo, behem ochlim imo mishalo. So that's the case of they both eat the new lamb, right? They're both he was their agent. He slaughtered the new lamb on behalf of them. They all get to eat the new lamb. Im shalahen nishchat rishon, but if theirs was slaughtered first, in which case he calls in their agent, heim ochlim mishalahen, but hu achel mishalo. In which case they both eat their own group, their own lamb. They become two separate chavurot. Okay. Im eino yodua. That's just the slaughtering at the same time, or you don't know which one came first. That's just two ways of saying you don't know which one came first. It's not really possible that they were really slaughtered exactly the same time. What we're saying is they were basically approximately the same time. There's no way to know which one was first. In that case, he can eat the lamb that he slaughtered. They can't eat any lamb because they are registered for it too, potentially. And theirs is therefore burnt because there's no owners. There's no clear owners for that lamb. But it turns out, but nonetheless, even though their Pesach became invalid, they would not have to do Pesach Sheni. The point being is that they were valid at some point. They were valid registrants at a certain point. It's not like they were impure by touching a corpse from the time that they were valid to eat a Pesach. They weren't. They were just they were pure at the time. They were what's the word? Registered correctly at the time, but then it became invalid afterwards. Why does it matter? If there is enough, shouldn't they just share? So that's exactly the point. You have to be registered for a maximum of one Pesach. That's the whole principle that's going through here. You can't be registered. There are two principles going. One of them is you don't want to leave a Pesach without an owner, which we'll see in a second. And the other one is everyone can only be registered for a maximum of one. So if you end up being registered for a two by accident, one of them has to go. Or maybe you can't eat any Pesach at all. That's the point. So they can't just share. They have to be registered for the specific Pesach that comes with it. Okay. Now is the next case, which sort of flips it around. Amar lahen. Now it's one person saying to a group of people, "Im echarti tzu v'shachatu alai. If I'm late, you should go and slaughter on my behalf." Okay. Is this d'oraita or d'rabbanan? I'm not sure exactly, but. My guess would be Doraita. I would also say the Mishnah doesn't have precise delineations between Doraita and Darabanan, so the Mishnah wouldn't necessarily clarify such a thing. I think the way the halakha falls out, this would probably be Doraita, but I'm not 100% certain about that. The Torah says, "Get a lamb for your household, you can't eat it, join with another family." Yes, that's correct. But the way the Mishnah understands that as well, however, is that you have to be registered for it. There has to be some kind of process of saying, yes, this is my lamb. You have to sort of designate it correctly. And that's the problem. The problem is designating. And I think one of the problems here is, like, this is a high stakes thing. You're designating a sacrifice for, you know, essentially Jewish Independence Day. It's like, this is an important event. You're dedicating something to God and to freedom. So you should know which lamb you're doing. You shouldn't have more than one. As a requirement, didn't need to be there. Yes, what I'm saying is that that the Mishnah may not have added it. That may just be the situation that existed in the Second Temple. Did the Sukkim have this idea? No, but the Torah doesn't imagine that you would ever slaughter the Pesach in the temple either. That's a totally later innovation. That's you only see that in Divrei Hayamim, in the books of Chronicles. So it's clearly a Second Temple idea that you would slaughter the Pesach in the temple. The Mishnah, the Torah thinks, obviously you do it at home. It's a totally homebound thing. The split hybrid temple home aspect only comes later on. But again, that's what I'm trying to say, basically. Sometimes you see the Mishnah and it's like, where did this thing come from? And you think, wow, the Mishnah just invented it. It's like, no, often the Mishnah didn't invent it. Actually, the Mishnah is just faithfully reproducing and discussing an ancient tradition, which maybe someone invented at some time, but it wasn't the Mishnah. They're often just transmitting traditional knowledge that they know. Something unnecessary, or you could say something amazingly valuable. Because what I think this whole idea of the Chavurah does is it really highlights the intention of doing your Pesach. So you have to really think about which Pesach you're going to do. You can't mess it up. It really raises the stakes and makes it a special occasion that you're having the right Pesach at the right time with the right people. It just makes it a much more intentional kind of thing. Anyway, back to the second case. The second case, as I said, is flipped. Now one person makes a whole bunch of people his agents. Halach u'matza'o v'shachat v'hein lakhu v'shachatu. But again, they both ended up slaughtering lambs. Im shalahen nishchat rishon hein ochlin mishalahen v'hu ocheli mahen. If theirs, the ones he made their agents, slaughtered first, they eat from theirs and he can eat with them. This is just the flip of the first case. So nothing has changed. It's just the plural and the singular have swapped. But if the individuals were slaughtered first, then they essentially have become two different groups. There was no shlichut, there was no agency, so they're now two different groups. If there's no way of knowing which one was slaughtered first, then they get to have a lamb. Exactly the same law as before. They get to have their lamb. He can't have any lamb because he's potentially registered for two Pesachs. And so therefore his Pesach has to go to the Beit HaSreifa. But he doesn't have to do Pesach Sheni for the same reason. So this is exactly the same scenario. It's just flipped. Like this. So again, now the individual is potentially registered for two Pesachs. The group is only registered for one, so therefore this one gets burnt. This individual gets nothing, gets no Pesach at all, because we don't know which Pesach he was actually registered for. Okay, that's just the flip side. It's exactly the same scenario, just the plural and the singular swapped. It doesn't matter how many people are being agents for how many people. Now this is where it gets fun. The last case is, now we've dealt with the individual being an agent and the group being an agent. What happens if they are both agents? So this is the case of Amar Lahen Va'amru Lo. So you're supposed to fill in the statements from before. So not only did he say to them, hey, if I'm late, can you do a Pesach for me? They also said to him, oh, by the way, we lost the Pesach. Can you get a new one? Okay, if that's the case, ochlin kulam min harishon, from the original Pesach. So what's going on over here? Because the second one should be burned. The second one is totally invalid. Let's talk about this. So this is now the case. They both slaughtered, let's see if this diagram will work. Yes, exactly. Cell phones are very important. Yeah, how did anyone like ever meet anybody before cell phones? You know, and you're like, oh, I'll meet in, you know, at the train station. Like, well, the train station is quite big. How am I supposed to know? Yeah. So they made him their agent, and he made them their agents. The original Pesach now. They only register for the original Pesach. Yeah, because basically, I think once they found their original Pesach, then. Yes, right. Once they found the original Pesach, then whatever a new Pesach that they made was irrelevant. They're essentially one group. They both already subscribe to this one Pesach. So they just slaughter this one. The second one is basically irrelevant. Yeah, you paid for a second lamb, but it's absolutely irrelevant. The first Pesach is what it is. This seems to undermine very well the idea, all who are hungry, let them come and eat my Pesach. Yeah. The all hungry, let them come and eat paragraph is from the Gaonic period, where they were certainly not eating a Pesach. And also, by the way, like certainly you could have the rest of the meal. You can share the rest of the meal with whoever you want. The main question is just about the Pesach itself as a higher level of sanctity. So for sure. There's actually a really interesting discussion about this in Josh Culp's Haggadah about this paragraph and the history of this practice of opening the door. For Elijah, where it comes from, the Seder is really, really very interesting. If you see Josh Culp's Haggadah, the Shechter Haggadah, he's got a whole essay about it. It's really, really, very, very, very interesting. Okay, so in this case, basically the second, they all subscribe to this Pesach, then somebody slaughtered the second, irrelevant. They will all subscribe to this one. They can all eat this one. However, im ein yadua eiza mehen nishchat rishon. Oh, sorry. Yeah, sorry. Let me say this again. Whichever of the sacrifices was sacrificed first, that's the one that they can do. They all essentially are one group, so any one of them could either the group or the individual can sacrifice the Pesach on behalf of the rest of them. So therefore, if the group sacrificed theirs first, they both get to eat from the group's Pesach. If the individual sacrificed his first, they both get to eat from the individual's. It just matters the order as to which Pesach was sacrificed first. That's the only thing that matters. So I should clarify that. And this would be the same case, by the way, if the same group designated one and then like slaughtered it and then designated another one and slaughtered it. Like they would eat the first one and not the second one. They would burn the other one. Exactly right. But if you don't know which one was first, there's no way to know which one of them was slaughtered first. Shnehem yotzi in the beit ha-sreifa. Both animals have to be burnt because they are now both subscribed to two Pesachs, and that can't stand. They are stuck. They don't know which one they are subscribed to, so they're just totally stuck. Yeah, their experience of food waste is very different from ours as well, because like actually throwing away an animal, that is a serious amount of money. Like this is a high stake situation. You know, the Chag Gadya lies to you when it says a goat is two tzitzit. That's an extremely low, 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 low price for a goat. For them, this would have been much more high stakes. For us, like we throw away food all the time, it doesn't bother us. For them, much bigger deal. Okay. That tells you how high stakes they thought this was, how important they thought it was to eat the correct Pesach. Lo amar lahem velo amru lo, einan achra'in ze lazeh. If it was just a group of people, but then they just like went off and happened, some of them slaughtered this one, some of them slaughtered that one, but they never spoke to each other about it. They would never had any shlichut arrangements, no sort of agency. They're not responsible for each other. This one did that, did their animal, this one did their animal. They're two different groups, no connection. Everything's fine. Okay, that was the Mishnah. Great. Okay, similar kind of dynamics, odd dynamics of groups. As we go on to the last two Mishnayot that we're going to learn in Pesachim, which we can do in 7 minutes. Shtei chavurot shenit arvu pischehen, eilu moshkin lahen echad, ve'eilu moshkin lahen echad. Echad me'eilu va lo eitzel eilu, ve'echad me'eilu va lo eitzel eilu, v'chach heim omrim. Im shalanu hu ha-pesach hazeh, yadecha mishuchot mishalach v'nimneita al shalanu. Ve'im shalcha hu ha-pesach hazeh, yadeinu mishuchot mishalanu v'nimneinu al shalach. So this is the situation. There are two groups They each of them had a different Pesach. They got mixed together. There's no way to know which Pesach belongs to which group. This is back to our no tagging situation. So they mixed up their Pesachs. Elu moshkin lahen achad ve'elu moshkin lahen achad. They both moshkin. They draw for themselves. They draw in for themselves one of the lambs. So they just take one at random. Here's you group take this one. You group take that one. Then however many people people in the group. One of them, one of the people from one group goes to the other group, and one of the people from that group goes to the other group. So there's an A and B who have swapped groups. Okay, which means that you're hedging your bets. And now in each of the new created groups, which is X minus one of the original group plus one from the other group, each of those, in each one of the groups, there is a maximum of a minimum of one person subscribed to this exact Pesach, for sure. Okay, so this is a way of doing this without ever leaving the Pesach without an owner. And then they make this declaration, which is they'll say to each other, "Im shelanu hu haPesach hazeh, if this Pesach turned out to be ours, yadecha meshuchot mishalcha v'nim neta al shelanu, then you have withdrawn from yours and you will be a subscribed to ours." And if this Pesach is yours, we will withdraw our hands from ours, and will be subscribed to yours. If the main prime person was not there, then the sacrifice is invalid. I think if the main prime person is not there because they died, there still is a main person for the sacrifice. How this interacts with that other principle is not totally obvious to me. But yes, that's a good question. But I think that it's different in the sense that the original owner, the main prime owner is still there. Just you don't know for sure they're on the right Pesach, but they're still there. Okay. And this, you can also do this procedure. V'chein chamesh chavarot shel chamisha chamisha v'shel asara asara. Moshkin lahen echad b'kol chavara v'chavara v'chein hem omrim. And by the way, you can actually do this procedure for any number of groups, as long as each group has the same has exactly the number in the group as the number of groups. So if you have 5 groups of 5, or 10 groups of 10, or 11 groups of 11, or whatever, 8 groups of 8, and all their Pesachs got mixed together, you could do exactly the same procedure. As long as one person rotates, so now you're creating a new group of 8 people, one of which was from each of the original lambs, which means you're guaranteed, every lamb is guaranteed to have at least one person who owns that lamb. And then they have this whole arrangement where they say, if it was yours, then then it's not ours. And if it was yours, then we're subscribed to yours. If it was ours, whatever. They do the same declaration. So this works with however many number of people, as long as you have enough people to make sure that every lamb has guaranteed one person that was originally subscribed to that lamb. It's actually very clever, very mathematical. They make a conditional agreement, as you say, Philip, sophisticated contract to get around the project. The problem, exactly. This is a pretty common tactic for the Mishnah. They are very into these conditional statements, conditional contracts. So if it turns out to be yours, then I did this. If it turns out to be ours, then we also saw this before with this slave, right? The slave who goes to slaughter a Pesach for his master, but he forgot which animal was supposed to be slaughtered. He then slaughters both and then makes the argument, okay, if this was the Pesach, then it will be for my master, but if it isn't, then it will be mine, and same thing with the other one. A very common kind of Mishnaic move to make sure everything gets worked out. Okay. Now, the problem might come when you have exactly 2 people in the group. Say that again. Where you have 2 Pesachs only owned by one person. You might think that you would just swap the 2 people, but that's not good enough. Because you'll therefore end up even momentarily, you'll end up with a Pesach without any owners. Or potentially with the people end up with the wrong Pesach. So what you do in this case is Shnayim Shinit Arvu Pesachim, 2 individuals who own a Pesach and their Pesachs got mixed up. Zeh moshech lo echad, v'zeh moshech lo echad. They each take one of the lambs. Zeh mamneh imo echad min hashuk, v'zeh mamneh imo echad min hashuk. They each go out into the street and just take a random person, basically. They're they just subscribe somebody else. Somebody, doesn't matter who it is. Hey, you come here. Zerba Eitzel Zer, and then the people that they chose, they then swap groups. Okay? And this solves the problem. They make the declaration again. If it was yours, then I retract it, and you can be subscribed to mine, and vice versa. So this gets around it because. So this person can't be in another group. So you have to go to the street and find who isn't registered for Pesach yet, basically. You have to just like, you know, wander around the shuk and say like, okay, I need someone who isn't registered. Tell me who's not registered. And then you would add them to your group. So now you're two groups of two, and then the new people would swap. Because once you have two groups of two, then you can do the same procedure as over here. Basically, that's the point. The point is you don't want to just swap owners because then one of them might end up with an animal that they would not subscribe to. If you first increase the size of the group, then guaranteed you will end up in the end with somebody subscribed to that lamb, and the lamb will not remain ownerless. It's a very clever way around right here. Okay, thank you everyone. We learned a lot of Pesachim. On Monday we'll be beginning Masechet Ta'anit. It's not a sham process per se. It's a logical. It's not a sham in the sense that it is a real thing. Like you have subscribed that person to the lamb. That happened. That is a real legal thing. What you've done is sort of done a clever way round in order to avoid some undesirable consequences. Did subscribing involve having pay for the lamb? Yes, probably. Yeah, I'm sure if you got other people to agree, one of the main reasons you would do that is to say, hey, can you chip in for this lamb? Yeah, I think you paid for it. Great, so thank you. That was Pesachim. I'm happy to take questions at my email address whenever you want. And I'll see you all on Monday. Shabbat Shalom.